Mormon Matters Podcast is a production of the Open Stories Foundation and is seeking to build financial support separate from Mormon Stories Podcast. All donations to Mormon Matters are fully tax deductible and go directly towards keeping the podcast alive and towards building a community of support for Mormons like you. To support the podcast or to join the community, please become a monthly subscriber today at mormonmatters.org.
Hello, everyone. This is Dan Weatherspoon.
Kia ora, everyone. This is Gina Colvin.
And hello, this is Natasha Helfer-Parker.
Many of you will know the three of us as podcasters. Gina hosts a Thought for Faith podcast. Natasha hosts Mormon Mental Health. And I host the Mormon Matters podcast. And we three have been talking for a little while about getting together for a discussion, bringing our different perspectives together on some things. And it came together that we felt like we ought to respond in some ways to at least one of the issues that was raised at conference this past weekend. And it's basically the question of voice and how are you heard and what is it that we can do and what are the dynamics that are behind the frustrations of not always being heard in the church, of sort of being somebody who is trying to be authentic in our church and sort of running headlong into a culture and sort of an institutional setup and things like that that isn't easily accessible to us. And so, for instance, it's the actions by the group Any Opposed that led us to, let's concentrate on this for a podcast together. So we're not making any kind of statement one way or the other about the nature of that action from the group Any Opposed, so much as just simply talking about the dynamics that kind of lead to that and possible ways to, you know, not be quite so frustrated that things would lead to actions like this, these dramatic gestures and whatnot. Is there a way for us to do our Mormonism, to do it in our local communities, to do it with our leaders and those within the sound of our voice and things like this in ways that we are heard even when it seems like the institutional deck doesn't have easy and great channels? So let me quickly make sure that everyone kind of knows what happened. This conference was unusual, and it got certainly some media attention in that a group of people, and those of us who were kind of connected with the online Mormon community kind of knew it was happening. There was an effort to get some tickets to conference for the Saturday afternoon session, which is traditionally, and it was again here, the session in which they sustain the presiding officers and things of the church. And a group of people, it ended up being seven folks, chose after the call for a sustaining vote for President Monson and the rest of the first presidency to stand up and say, "I oppose," when it came to sustaining them. And they did it one more time when it came to sustaining the 12 apostles. In each case, it looked like President Uchtdorf, who is the one who was calling for the sustaining votes and leading that part of the conference, was prepared for it, as he simply said, "The no votes have been noted." And then a little bit later, as he, you know, turned things over, President Monson, it appears, usually they'll say the sustaining was unanimous, etc. He says, "The votes have been taken. Those who are opposed to any of these things, please see your stake presidents." And then he thanked the members of the church for their love and support for everybody who's serving in these callings. So obviously they were prepared for it, but it's an important moment to talk about because of the issues, like we mentioned earlier, that it raises up about voice and being heard within the church and this organizational structure. So we're just going to free flow today. We're going to start with that. And because of all the different things that we shared with each other leading into this, I don't know if the focus will always stay there, but that's at least where we want to launch. So Gina Colvin, I'm going to turn the time over to you. You wrote a very interesting blog post today. This is Tuesday that we're recording at the Tuesday After Conference. Why don't you lead us through some of the things that you said there And let's use that as a springboard to begin this topic of voice within the church.
Well, as these things do, Dan, they usually arise out of extraordinary irritation. And my irritation began with, and my anger began with the tweet by Mark, the assistant coach. Is he a coach or the assistant coach of the BYU Cougars team?
I think he's one of the position coaches. Yeah, so one of the assistants.
Okay. And I think it was a misguided tweet done in a moment of hot-headedness, but it basically seemed to threaten violence to those people who stood and opposed. And it really concerned me because it's just heartbreaking to see our church come to this place of extremes, like extremes in our stridency against the status quo and extremes in our stridency to preserve preserve the status quo. And we're sort of caught in this awful sort of breach, firing, across the priority at each other. So really, I drew on, and this came out of a conversation that I had with Levina Anderson about a commencement speech at Cornell in 1968 by a chap called John W. Gardner, who talked about uncritical lovers and loving critics. One of his great quotes was, "Pity the leader caught between unloving critics and uncritical lovers." And an unloving critic is, he bemoans, as somebody who is bent on the destruction of the organization and has no love for it and wishes it to end, and whose actions create huge amounts of tension, and, you know, they're not interested in a flourishing institution. And the uncritical lovers are those he talks about being those who love without criticism. And love without criticism, he argues, brings stagnation, and criticism without love brings destruction.
Mm-hmm.
He also says that on the one side, those who love their institutions tend to smother them in the embrace of death, loving their rigidities more than their promise, shielding them from life-giving criticism. On the other side, there arises a breed of critics without love, skilled in demolition but untutored in the arts by which human institutions are nurtured and strengthened and made to flourish. And I was wondering aloud in my blog post at Kiwi Mormon, if we couldn't have more critical lovers and those people who love the institution but are confident and courageous to make a call for our community to be healthier. And they pose, critical lovers pose hard questions. They say difficult things, but not with the intention of destroying, but always with the intention of drawing us together in communion with each other about how we can be differently better. So that was my rant of the day.
Yes, it was a good one. Well, I would assume that those who listen to R3 podcasts, we're not going to identify ourselves with the unloving critics. I mean, there's certainly going to be a segment who perhaps is still listening to these podcasts who do now, at this point in their journey, wish the church ill and don't want it to succeed. And so they just work to stir the pot. But let's just assume for the sake of our conversation today that the rest of us are trying to be, to fall in that thing of how to skillfully, how to genuinely, how to, with integrity within our hearts, both love and say what we think out loud as far as, trying to call it to the highest self. I love that framing. Natasha, would you weigh in on Gina's post and that dynamic and, you know, bring some of your psychology stuff to relationships and all that into it? That'd be great.
Well, I loved what Gina wrote, and I love this idea of the loving critic. And I think what's so interesting about this opposed process that happened over General Conference and the reaction that we had to it is that the system is actually built into allow for opposition, and yet we're also shocked when it happens.
Right.
or you know, we just can't even tolerate it hardly.
In the early church, they did it all the time.
Oh yeah, they did it all the time. It was funner, I'm assuming, or more interesting anyway, to be at these meetings. But and how it was actually built into the system, a system that we ourselves claim is divine, you know, but yet when people take advantage of the system that's there, then it's seen as disrespectful or somehow not sustaining. And so I just want to play with some ideas here that I'm writing down as Gina's talking, but I think the word sustain is an interesting one. And when I look up the definition of sustaining, there's two different pieces of it. One is to support or to strengthen. And there's, of course, an argument to be made that you can be a critique or critique somebody in a way that is meant to be supportive. I think, again, in family dynamics, we see this all the time. I mean, my husband constantly shares the ideas with me, and you know, I do as well. How we go about that is oftentimes whether or not we're successful in making our points come across and whether or not we're listened to. But I would never expect my husband to just bow to me and tell me I'm always correct, or, you know, never have an opinion that differs from me. And that's I still see him as very much sustaining of me and myself and my personhood and my roles in the lives that we have together. So there's that. But then also another meaning to sustain is that to undergo or suffer something. And so I think that that's interesting in the sense that as members of a larger community, there will always be grievances or wounds that we all sustain from having relationship with one another. And so I think that, for example, for these members who chose to oppose, that's the voice that they're giving. They're giving a voice to whatever wounds or disagreements or concerns that they have that, to your point, Dan, earlier, I don't think we've got great ways to make those known or to give voice to those without feeling or being treated as an enemy to the state, in a sense, right? And to be seen as a threat. So I think that's concerning. And I can completely understand why, at least at this point of time, where there's so much friction around some of the excommunications that we've had, so much friction about how we are as members supposed to agree to disagree or discuss things that, you know, we may not agree with. There's this whole public versus private debate that's very confusing. We are also in the midst of a tremendous, as we can see by the themes of General Conference, a tremendous rift on the role of marriage, you know, with LGBT supporters, many within our church, and of course, many outside of our church, and not knowing how to deal with an entire General Conference that very much had no tolerance for that concept. So, you know, where are those opposing or dissenting voices supposed to go? And not to disrespect Brother or President Uchtdorf, but, you know, addressing that with your stake president at a local level, I know from my own experience and from many, many experiences that I've heard that is not, it can be a healing conversation and it can be a good conversation to have with a stake president, but it's by no means going to change the policies or the ways that we run and do things. It's just not how our church works. So there isn't really a lot of space to be able to say, hey, I feel strongly about this. I need to share my voice and how and where and how do I do that? So in the next, sorry if I'm talking too long, but the next thing that my mind tangents to is this idea of silence. And when you are being silenced, how that can actually play a traumatic role in your life. And we see that with all different kinds of trauma victims, that when there's no space or room for dialogue or conversation, that this actually has traumatic effects on people. It affects authenticity. It affects people's ability to feel right in the world. And, you know, looking at it from the gospel perspective, when we have this beautiful perspective on personal revelation, that gets really squashed when there's no room for personal voice that might disagree with the majority. And so that can become very confusing and very spiritually hurtful for people to go through. And I think something that many of us don't yet completely fully understand is the depth that faith transition can, just the mental health effects that it can have on people, to the point that, I mean, it's not a full-blown diagnosis, but it is a, only mental health professionals will know what I'm talking about, but it's a V code in the DSM-5. In other words, it's not something that insurance will pay for as far as a diagnosis, but it's sufficient of a problem that it's in the diagnostic manual as far as something to assess for as a mental health professional is if somebody's going through a faith transition that can have really very problematic aspects to their lives. So those are kind of some of the thoughts I've had. Making sure that we don't equate love to agreement or obedience. You know, and if anybody has a teenager, this should be very clear. You know, they can love you all day long and they may not obey or agree with you, but that really does nothing to do with how much love we have for another. Now, whether or not we're treating each other with respect, you know, that's always...
Or whether our communication with each other is skillful and constructive versus destructive.
Right. But then this often, I mean, again, we often tend to blame more the victim than the people. I mean, you know, people sure. can agree or disagree with how skillful the members of the supposed movement were. But at the same time, most people are not saying, well, how skilled or unskilled is the church at communicating with its members, especially right. on issues that are so raw, you know, rift with really personal injury and, you know, just so much, so many stories, as we well know, right, that are currently within our family system as Mormons that are very different than what was presented at General Conferences last weekend.
Natasha, I have a question. From your professional perspective, what is that human need that we have to express ourselves and not to be silent? What's that?
Okay, so I guess, well, we all, most of us are born with a voice, so obviously there's a reason for that. But and I don't know that it would be classified as one of the main needs for survival, but I think that we could all agree that the need to develop and progress, and this is very much also within Mormon doctrine, the whole idea of a personal progression has to do with thought and process and figuring things out for oneself and being able to communicate that with others. We do not progress in island type situations. We are very relational creatures, and therefore we do see correlations with mental health on how people feel supported and validated and heard versus those who feel ostracized or marginalized or ignored. There's huge differences in optimism and ability to flourish and bloom and have, you know, good quality of life.
So would it be more healthy to speak and be ostracized for your words or to remain silent?
Well, that's a very good point. And I think that depending on personality and a lot of different things, we see people responding obviously in both of those ways. And we see that all around us. There are people who are raped and never say anything about it. And there are people who are raped and, you know, go and have everything done that they're supposed to do medically and, you know, charge their perpetrator and everything. So there's a huge, and I guess this is where I want to be careful, because I'm a strong believer in that after working with as many people as I have, is that people tend to do what's best for them. And if you have like less coping skills or more trauma in your past or, you know, kind of more checks against you, your ability to really be able to propel your voice forward or do things as we would deem quote unquote correct are going to be less than, and that's not necessarily bad. That's, you know, we all develop our survival mechanisms for whatever reasons, and those are very individualized. I would say ideally, yes, the voice is better. The authenticity is better. But when that's met with cultural and community rejection, that comes at such a cost often that I can completely understand why people choose the silence. And we see that in our community, unfortunately, all the time.
There's less and less reason to feel that one needs to be silent these days, don't they? Because, I mean, people are finding each other in social media and in spaces, and, you know, if nobody else is around in their immediate physical circles, you know, there's always somebody
For example, would this, would this little faction of any oppose, would they have even been able to gather the courage? Because whether you agree with it or not, this was a courageous act. This took a lot of guts to stand in a space where they knew they would not be welcome and to speak up. But to your point, I'm guessing they found each other through these types of groups where they can find support. Whereas if we didn't have the internet, it'd be very hard to find those things.
Mm, and that's the epoch we find ourselves in now, that everybody is finding like-minded people who give them support, even when, you know, their ward members or, families can't. So it's kind of injecting a lot of courage.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think that's what we're seeing with the ordained women movement. I think that's what we're seeing with, the blogosphere that we call it, right? I think that's what we're seeing with many, many people that can find like-minded individuals. Of course, the opposite, the double-edged sword on that is that what we're also finding up through internet studies is that we tend to find those who are like us. That's a very human tendency. So instead of expanding our horizons or being willing to listen to other perspectives, we're more inclined to just fall in line with those that would have, you know, our beliefs. So there's a little bit of pros and cons to the whole internet movement, but definitely I would agree with you, Gina, that support, especially for marginalized groups, is a very positive thing.
I'm worried too, Natasha, with that second thing that you brought up about, you know, how we can tend to get into the echo chamber. And then, you know, those few times that we do venture out or, you know, we'll post our thoughts on a conservative or a vice versa, conservatives will post in sort of more of a progressive setting. It usually doesn't go well. So, and that's kind of what we've been noticed. We just don't know how in this church at this moment in time to really engage with each other. And many of you know that I've worked with Randy Paul on different things. He's the president of that Foundation for Religious Diplomacy. And basically, his whole thing is not so much what you say, but how you say them. You know, that's the key thing. And I'm guessing, Natasha, that that's what you find in marriages. It's not going to be that a good marriage is a tension-free marriage. It's a good marriage is somebody that knows how to communicate their wants and needs and just do it effectively, right? And knowing that there's that baseline love.
Yeah, I mean, Gottman talks a lot about this. If you're familiar with the work of John Gottman, yes. He's one of the relational experts in our nation today. And so he talks about, you know, in healthy marriages, kind of this ability to move back and forth between allowing your spouse to influence you. In other words, my spouse's opinion matters, and I'm going to give it the benefit of the doubt, and I'm going to agree with it, and I'm going to validate it, and I'm maybe even going to change my mind because my spouse is so cool and important. So you're going to have that kind of juxtaposed by also this ability to tolerate difference and to tolerate, different opinions and able to, respect each other's individuality. So those are, again, a position of principles in a sense, but both need to be present. And in fact, the one that probably needs to be a little bit more present is that of allowing each other to influence, you know, each other. So there's more of that we against the world, or I know you've got my back type of foundation, so that then we can for sure tolerate some of the differences that we're bound to have.
And ultimately, to me, you move past eventually to toleration to this is enlivening. This is wonderful. This is what makes my marriage even better. The fact that we disagree and that we still do our little dance on opinions and the way things should be doing it, but we're not we don't find these things deadening our relationship but enlivening it. So is that just too hard a step? Probably, or at least it's a second step.
No, I love that. I mean it's very easy to love looks like yourself.
Right, right.
We're all very egocentric in that way, and so it's very easy to love what's familiar. And I often tease couples about this because, you know, I'll say, well, what drew you to this person to begin with? Well, you know, they were so exciting and full of life and spontaneous. And now the main complaint is, you know, they do things without talking to me, or they, you know, well, and so the things that drew you to that person are oftentimes the things that turned around and drive you crazy later. But so there's that sense of being able to grow and stretch with this person who's really a complete another culture, all, you know, encapsulated in one another body. And again, this falls very much in line with Mormonism's take on marriage, and that it's, you know, kind of a refiner's fire. And yet when it comes to this relationship that we have with the church, which is oftentimes also talked about in scripture as a marriage, we seem to not, you know, tolerate that type of approach, that it really has to be a submissive spouse, kind of more like an abusive relationship than this, you know, give and take of peers and adults that are, you know, willing to engage with one another. And to your point, Dan, I know you like to use the word wrestle with each other a lot. So
yeah, thanks. Now let's clarify: does the scriptural injunction that we're in a marriage with the church, or we're in a marriage with Christ?
With Christ.
I'm just wondering about that. I've used the marriage analogy, and I've quoted a rabbi that I liked from a Krista Tippett thing, where she kind of saw herself as in a relationship with the church, and she even uses the term marriage, and it's, in other words, I'm in a relationship, and it's a relationship that's important to me, yet it's a relationship that makes me pull my hair out at the same time, you know, and my tears make the relationship even more sacred, and she uses that thing, but I'm not positive that the scriptures have used that, because in other words, if the scriptures are saying be in a marriage relationship and be the submissive spouse, I want to know those scriptures versus, because I'm not sure that that's what Christ would want of us.
I meant to say that, yeah, there's oftentimes the visual imagery of Christ and the church being married, right? And so the church is us.
Oh, that's what you meant. Okay.
Right. So I guess what I'm saying is that absolutely, I don't think Christ wants us to be in a submissive, punitive role with us. But I think that oftentimes our church culture does expect that. So I guess that's what I meant. So I need to clarify. Whereas it's more punitive if you disagree, or if you're going to be at odds with each other, that's seen as you being a bad spouse.
Right.
The Old Testament, of course, has that punitive relationship with, you know, the God of Israel and the children of Israel in this marriage relationship, which is highly dysfunctional, involving lots of whoring around and, you know.
Yeah, that's right.
Bit schlepping of naughty Israel, the wife. So, yeah.
Yeah, interesting. Well, let's talk about this. We're in a relationship with the church. The church is supposedly in a relationship with Christ and all that stuff. Do you guys find it healthy to think of ourselves as, you know, perhaps, so we've raised the spouse question. Do you like the child question too, as the church as a parent, and they want us to be children? Or what do you guys think? Is it helpful for you to think of yourselves as, you know, trying to break, you know, well, Natasha, I know you've talked in past podcasts about differentiation and how that's a healthy stage in any human life when you move from a child, you know, into adolescence and into adulthood and differentiation. Are you comfortable saying that the church has struggles with its members moving out of childhood?
Yeah, I'm definitely comfortable saying that. I mean, I think that, you know, again, these thoughts and these parables even are very useful, and depending on where we're at in our lives, you know, there's definitely times that I have felt like a child and felt very humble and have appreciated that concept of, you know, be like little children. And, you know, when I think about the vastness of the universe and all that I do not know, I feel very childlike, you know, so there's, mm-hmm. there's definitely that perspective of gospel teaching. But you know, in Mormonism, we also have this wonderful perspective of being invited to become as God and therefore a peer of God. And I know you've spoken to this as well. And there are definitely times, you know, as we study and as we contemplate, I mean, Mormons do a lot of studying. I've spent a lot of time, you know, with my scriptures and with, you know, just kind of thinking through religious and philosophical thoughts. And therefore, it comes to a point where I feel some, not necessarily pride, but some sense of ability to think through an issue and have a valid opinion about it and not feel bad about that. You know, like I feel like I can have that, and that God would want me to feel strong about the convictions that I've come to. And I think that's where we struggle as a church culture, because such of the hierarchy and how it's set up from a governing perspective is authoritarian. It is patriarchal, and therefore you're not necessarily able to, you know, disagree to a level where policy or direction is going to change if you're not necessarily privileged by a certain position in the church.
Right.
Does that make sense? And so that's where I think many of us are left feeling like toddlers or adolescents when we're very much in adulthood and yet not being respected or treated as adults.
Yeah. Let me follow up with that. So would you say that the brethren one-on-one with you, if they knew it wasn't going to go beyond the room, you know what I mean? If, you know, if you're meeting with them and you didn't have access to them, would they say something different than what they seem to allow happen? In other words, would they say, oh, of course we want you to be spiritual adults. Of course we don't want you to hang on our every word. Of course we want you to have your own spiritual connection with God. We want you to be grown-ups of God. And yet we have this cultural situation where it doesn't seem like the institutional rhetoric, or when they're speaking to the larger body, they want that. Would you grant that, or would you say, even one-on-one, the brethren say, you know, it's a lot better because we have the priesthood and we have the office, and it's best for you to always think of yourself as a child?
Well, I don't know what you would say, Gina, to this, but I would say there's a lot of both. I mean, I've been in situations where I've asked those questions behind closed doors, not necessarily of apostles, but, you know, of my own priesthood leaders. And, you know, both of those answers have been forthcoming. I've sat through general conferences where right over the pulpit, both of those were forthcoming. Mm-hmm. So it does tend to be a bit confusing. I think any Mormon, you sat them down and say, well, are you just blind sheep that follow leaders? Everybody would say, absolutely not. You know, I have my own convictions. I have my own agency. I have my own ability to pray for answers. But at the same time, when it comes right down to it, if you're going to be putting forth an opposing view, you are going to get some of that rhetoric of, well, you know, we've been taught that we follow the prophet. We've been taught that to put the trust in the authority of the priesthood. And that's something that, you know, quite frankly, Sister Parker, you don't have.
Gina, what do you think on that? And then I want to come back to your question of your statement of opposing view, Natasha.
So reframe the question again, Dan.
One-on-one or behind closed doors, if the brethren didn't feel like every time that they were speaking, they had to speak to the whole church and they had to speak at, you know, a level within a bandwidth that would appeal to the center, that would appeal to the person who really is looking for them for assurance and guidance, etc. Do you feel like behind closed doors they would be encouraging for us to grow and be spiritual adults, to get your own relationship with God, even if it were to disagree with them? Or do you feel like that they would want to keep you childlike?
I don't. In my experience, I haven't felt that they wanted to keep me childlike. That's anecdotally. I know that other people have had different experiences. I've been very fortunate with my priesthood leaders, and I have been able to be very authentically, combative, for want of a better word, and have, you know, quite forcefully resisted the notion to them that, you know, I won't be controlled by an organization. I mean, I think my priesthood leaders know that I don't believe the church has the capacity to take care of all of my emotional and my spiritual needs, that I absolutely need to have some independence. And I've made it very clear to them in the past that, look, the church is just an institution. It's an agent of socialization. It's there for the management of the religious masses. It's aligned institutionally and ideologically with the state, more particularly the United States. It's got its own imperatives, its own kind of economic and its cultural and social imperatives and exigencies. It's refracted through like a national interest. Like, it's just not ever going to be enough.
Right.
And I've always felt that that was respected and understood. But I say that because largely because of an accident of my birth. You know, I'm in New Zealand, and I think there is an element of many New Zealanders that I know that acknowledge on some level that the church can't be enough because it's American.
Mm.
Like it doesn't hear New Zealand, you know, it doesn't hear right. our Kiwi culture enough for us to entirely trust all of the processes. Now, I might be misrepresenting some very, very conservative, you know, New Zealand Mormons here. I know that there are quite a few of them whose sense of social self and cultural self is somewhat diminished by the overarching sort of, you know, the largeness of the kind of an American church. And they're okay with that. They've submitted that part of themselves. But there is some kind of, you know, there is, I've noticed, some kind of cynicism in that. So it requires us to kind of form a language and a sense of identity in the breach that the church creates between a very American Mormon cultural experience that's refracted through and out of Utah and the you know, our own experiences. So, you know, maybe it's just me, but, you know, I think I can speak for other people who've had the experience of an understanding that it can't be parent. It can't ever be enough.
That's great. And so you call it an accident at birth. It's a happy accident, though, in some ways, right? Because you're, in some ways, maybe learning a lesson or having it so evident to you at all the times where those of us in the United States don't quite as easily get to that, and we struggle more. Or would you say that every New Zealander really struggles with this, or is it just more like the air that you breathe that there's, you know, this, you know, well, that's the U.S.?
Well, I mean, I can't speak for you. Obviously, I can't speak for every New Zealander, and I know that there are particular enclaves of Mormonism that find what I say quite distasteful. I just think it's it's just for me, it's just not possible to see the lack of fit. Do you know? It's yeah. not possible. It's not possible to understand the church in this place and what it stands for as an American institution. I mean, for instance, when I was young, you know, we grew up in a welfare state, you know, a socialist democracy, and something that, you know, my parents and my grandparents were deeply proud of. You know, it meant all sorts of things in terms of, well, it did have high taxation, but, you know, we had all of those things that in the kind of post-McCarthyist, post-Fordist American era that, you know, missionaries and mission presidents would come out to New Zealand and they would be horrified. They would call us communists and socialists, and they would sort of tell us how dreadful it was that we lived in this place that, you know, didn't have this full-blown capitalist mentality, and, you know, how Zion, you know, looked like Utah. This wasn't Zion, but it was a nice place to come and be a tourist, you know. And I looked around me and I thought, you know, I've always thought, you've so diminished, you know, our nation, and you've diminished my own people who doesn't, you know, maybe they don't brandish big, you know, fingers dripping with jewelry and your big bouffant hairdos and your nicely cut suits, but these are good, fine people. And that, you know, pissed me off even when I was a kid. You know, I could mm-hmm. see, I'm like, you know, I just wanted to say, shut up. You don't know what you're talking about. Maybe it's me, but I mean, you know, maybe this is kind of the people that I grew up around. So maybe it's just Christchurch, it's my city, but yeah.
Well, what I'm trying to push you in, though, is, you know, not that however you got there, you're glad that you got there and that you have this distance with the church, is I guess what I'm saying. And I'm wondering if that's something that we on this podcast could be simply saying, how do the rest of us, you know, just give up this quest to think that the institution will ever meet our needs, you know, and do we need some organizational behavior lessons to teach us about how, you know, the rhetoric of an organization is never going to be nuanced? You know, do we need some lessons on how, you know, company or institutional cultures grow up and they're always going to be conservative? They're always going to be towards the status quo. What is it that we need to kind of get to this critical distance with the church to be able to claim that space to be the spiritual adult that we're kind of all agreeing we want to be.
Well, I think, Dan, it comes back to a relationship with God. Like, it absolutely
does. So if you have a relationship with God, you're saying you're going to feel empowered.
I think so. I don't feel fearful. Do you know, I see a lot of fear out there, but I just don't feel fearful. And I believe, you know, I think Krista Tippett, you mentioned Krista Tippett before, she talks about her capacity, her belief in the capacity for religion to nourish life and to nourish community. And I think that's fundamental. So two things, like a belief in the capacity of religion to be nourishing and to be good, to be fundamentally good. So I believe in that, and I also believe in God, and I believe in my relationship with God that surpasses my relationship with the institution. I don't channel my relationship with God or the divine through an institution.
Okay, but yet somewhere along the line, you either got the message and you took the steps to get that relationship with God, or were there things that helped clear that space to where you said, this is the only way I'm going to survive, is to go to God myself and to feel that?
Oh, I think like numerous experiences. Most of us have, as Mormons, have had numerous encounters with the divine.
See, I'm not so positive about that.
Really? Really? Why would you do this?
Well, that's the thing. The consistent pushback I get on Mormon Matters is that I'll say similar things to you, and there are people who come out of, you know, they write me, they're, you know, consistent commenters on the blogs. There is no there. You're talking about a relationship with God. You're talking about spirit. I've never had a spiritual experience. They've never had anything that feels anything beyond the emotional experiences, where they feel like their emotions were manipulated by stories or the, you know, the swell of emotion that comes when communal hymns are sung or something. And they haven't felt that fundamental pathway to God or that channel open up and have energies flow.
Wow. I don't.
Yeah. Well, can I butt in here for a minute? So, I think that a lot of this, unfortunately, has to do with language. I think that, you know, when you grow up, for example, in an LDS framework, and this could really be any religious framework, and you're told, okay, this, because you know what you're talking about, Dan, you know, the institution, but this is not just an institution. This isn't a company. This is like representing God. They're pretty clear that this is God's will. And so if you're told your whole life that, you know, this organization represents God and God's will for you, and this is how you have a spiritual experience, and these are the things that you need to do to have those spiritual experiences, then, you know, if it works, great. And we see that all over the place where it works for people just the way it's kind of described, and people have a wonderful relationship with the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, as they do with Catholicism or, you know, 500 other religions, where the equation that the institution is putting forth works for those people. But equally, or even more than equally, there are many, many people who do not have that scripted experience that the institution is putting forth as their relationship with God. So this is where I think it becomes important to, you know, for Gina, that's relationship with deity. But I think that there's something about spirituality, or whatever language you want to place in that, that I call those moments where you feel enlightened. And I think most of us have had those, whether we're listening to a song, or whether we're reading a science book, or whether we're reading scripture, or whether we're meditating, or whether we're looking at a sunset. And granted, emotions are always involved in those moments, as they are often with intellectual moments. So emotions are just kind of there regardless. But I do think that most of us could speak to enlightenment. And I think that's where, unfortunately, this tension happens with the church, is that they are prescribing a very set rule, a very set kind of way of going about spirituality. When people don't resonate with that, then they end up feeling like, well, I'm the one that's doing something wrong. Because of course the church is saying, we're not doing something wrong. This is God. God is never wrong. And so when you're dealing with people or an institution that claims to be speaking in the behalf of God, there's really no room for dialogue, because God trumps everything else. this is where I see the dialogue breaking down and where we really don't have the skills. And I think it goes beyond having individual skills. There are obviously individuals like Gina that end up having a pretty healthy relationship with the church because they have either cultural or personality or whatever types of traits that help them get to these spaces of being able to have healthy communion with their religion. And many do not have that capacity because it was never engendered, it was never supported, it was dangerous, or like you're saying, fearful to even delve into those waters. Where, you know, we have the classic, it's Satan. Satan's tempting you. Satan's deceiving you. Satan, Satan, Satan. It takes all personal ability to have a valid experience other than the prescribed effect. Does that make sense?
Totally. My last podcast mentioned the same thing. I had Phil Barlow and Carlisle Hunsaker on. And one of the things that Phil talked about is how the Moroni 10, 3 through 5 has become basically the only way that you're able to feel the Spirit. You know, in other words, ask with sincere heart, believing that you'll receive an answer, and, you know, the Holy Ghost will tell it to you, and then you, you know, couple that with DNC 9, it'll be a burning in your bosom, and yet he's saying the scriptures have so many million more, you know, ways that God can work with you. You know, the still small voice, it tastes good, you know, the seed, you know, begins to take root, and it swells within you and all those kinds of things. And so I think you're right. He's right that we have a very limited repertoire of what it means when the Spirit is talking to you. But Gina's point is so interesting because she's where I'm at. I think my main ability to differentiate between me and the church and to have this healthy distance to where, you know, I feel like I'm operating fine within the structure of this institution. Mine comes also from personal experiences with God, with knowing that I'm accepted, you know, et cetera, to knowing that I'm on a good path, that, you know, God is working with me, and how he works with me or how they work with me, God's. That's it for me. So Gina, and apparently that's it for you, because you're surprised that not everybody feels that.
Well, Yeah.
So how do we, Natasha, does a lot of your people come in and say, you know, I'm a Mormon, a lifelong Mormon, and yet it's never caught me spiritually?
Well, sure. Yes, I get that a lot. And I think oftentimes, obviously, most of us have a hard time looking back on our lives and being completely accurate about what's happened, because we're also looking through a current lens. Mm. And so those are just hard things for any of us to completely parse out. And you know, and I've also had many people tell me, I feel like I've had spiritual experiences, but now that my current paradigm doesn't allow for deity, then I don't know how to make sense of those experiences, you know? So there's a great variety of ways that people are struggling to make sense of their lived experience.
So what's the recommendation from either of you? Go have them or work in other areas, and perhaps you'll have that experience come as a byproduct of, you know, trying to expand yourself. You know, Gina, when you were talking about how you put it to your leaders, you know, clearly there's so much of your education and your, you know, your cultural awareness and your, you know, you're a pedagogy person, and you're, you know, you've done a lot about colonialism and things like that. So there was so much informing what you said. Would you recommend, you know, people, you know, write down notes, take, you know, really inform yourself about individuals and institutions or something like that, and leave the Spirit thing aside? Or do we just kind of constantly say, you know, pray and seek something that they feel is not, they've never had come?
I don't know. Like, Dan, when I was growing up, I had a Catholic father, I had a Mormon mother, I had an Anglican grandmother, and I had people who had cared for me, because my mother was a working mother. My stepfather was Catholic, who were evangelicals and Baptists. And it wouldn't be unusual for me to go to all three services on one day. And I recall just being swept away by all of it, like no differentiation whatsoever. And I recall one day saying to my Oma, which I call her, I said, well, why don't you come to Mum's church? which was the Mormon church. And she was aghast. She said, I wouldn't go to that devil's church. And that was the first time that I had realized that there was tension between the religions, because for me it was all about God, but people were just doing it in really different and cool ways. So I think my spiritual life has always been nourished by a very, very broad sense of where God's presence can be felt. I have a son who sings at the Christchurch Cathedral. He's a chorister every Sunday, and sometimes I go and I take the Eucharist, and I absolutely feel transformed. And I don't have any fear of kind of moving between these spaces. If I can find God in those spaces, I'm happy to find God. And I don't know what it is.
Okay, you're not answering my question, but it's great that you're sharing your own experience here. Do you find it helpful to go get educated, or would you? You're still pointing, at least with these anecdotes, to the experiential realm of seeking the experience rather than the intellectual framing.
Well, I think it goes hand in hand. I mean, the intellectual framing. I've always been a spiritual person. But I think the spiritual experience, I think is something to thirst for and strive for and really seek for. And I think the intellectual work that comes along with it, you know, the intellectual work should kind of accompany it. That critical work, that sort of passing out the spiritual realm from the mortal realm, you know, what is it about mortality? What is it about human institutions that set up a caution for us to deeply engage with them as a source of all of our spiritual, framing or our spiritual experiences, because they're never going to do it. Only God will. Maybe they'll facilitate it, you know, but, you know, sometimes we're just in such a dysfunctional relationship or we can't see the institution for what it is.
That's good. Well, the loving, back to the loving critic or the uncritical lover versus the critical lover, loving critic, you're basically saying the love part is going to be probably the experiences of, you know, God involved, or I feel spirit, I feel transformed. These things are, you know, churches and religion somehow sets me up for some kind of transformative experience, and that helps me to be a lover. The critical stuff, I guess we'd say, would come from the education and from hearing, you know, you process out loud and Natasha process out loud and the guys I had on last week process out loud, just these dynamics of institutions. You know, to me, the simplest one of them all is simply to take what Jesus said about the Sabbath and just apply it to the church. Is the church for us, or are we for the church? And I think most people ultimately get that the church is here to serve our needs. We're not here to wear out our life for the great good of the church. You know, it's nice when we serve, and it's neat that it, you know.
You think that most people feel that way?
Well, I think within 30 seconds of conversation, they do. Just the way that, just the way
I would
they
disagree
make, they,
with that.
Oh, really? So in other words, the church is the great good rather than our human growth is the great good?
Well, okay, sure, human growth, but the whole, you know, concept of consecration and really sacrificing what's good for us for the benefit of church and Zion and
okay, let's say the organization. So you're right. The church as a community, the church as a Zion idea, you're right. There that would add some nuance. But I guess I'm thinking about the institution with all of its rules and all of its cultural quirks and all of its, if you don't get your numbers, you're screwed, you know, kind of thing.
Well, so as I'm hearing you both speak about, you know, this experience with deity in particular, I'm just, you know, because I would say that personally, from a personal perspective, I'm probably on board with you two. But I'm always, you know, carrying around 500 million stories with me. So it's
right.
Which I feel very privileged to be carrying those. And so I have really come to have to understand, if I was going to work effectively with people, that, you know, my way was obviously not going to be the only way. And so, you know, as I think about the commonalities, like what's the common experiences, I definitely agree with this idea of personal progression with enlightenment that, you know, I think you'd be hard pressed to find human beings who wouldn't find value in continual learning, you know, wanting to better themselves, you know, wanting to, you know, focus on this idea of moving forward and onward. At the same time, whether or not we tie that to God is complicated, because for many of us, that's a very spiritual, sacred, even personal way to make sense of the growth that is happening. But again, when either the script doesn't fit your experience, which we've talked about already, or when deity is actually abusive, in other words, for many people, like, for example, you know, just as general conference, I'm sorry, but if you're a gay member of our church, our God is abusive. Okay, you were called counterfeit. You were told that in no way would you be able to have a family of worth if you were to marry a same gendered person. So that if you're buying into that, those words coming off the pulpit are divine verbiage coming from God, from God's people that are meant to tell you what God wants you to know, then all of a sudden there's a lot of cognitive dissonance there about how you're supposed to have a spiritual experience that feels ill to you. Okay. That feels, makes you feel nauseous and actually can make you suicidal. So, and another way that God becomes abusive is because, again, when we have systems of authority, God is an authority figure. And if you have authority figures in your life, so church aside, you know, whether it's your own biological parents or whomever it was that raised you who was abusive, there is a potential to get those concepts kind of mixed up in your own kind of intellectual processing. So for many people, deity is not safe. It's not loving. It's not progressive. It's not spiritual to them. And when we keep them in this box of, well, that's what it means to really progress, then I think those of us who have had very beautiful spiritual experiences really need to, you know, take some of our own medicine and say, okay, well, even though this has been great for me, I'm just as traditionalist, even though I may consider myself a very nuanced Mormon, if I portray that this is the only way that we can continue to progress is to even accept deity to begin with. So that's been my journey, is really this place of acceptance for a person's story, and to not see their development and progression through the lens of what I think it should be, yeah. Which is very difficult to do. It's very difficult to not place that burden on another person. Is, you know, my experience should be your experience. And if you're not having that experience, there's something obviously wrong with you, not me. Right?
Yeah, yeah.
And so this gets back to family dynamics. You know, which is kind of what I try to come back to, is a sense of whether it's deity or the relationship we have with the church or 500 other topics, until we can truly learn to accept and sit and tolerate with the fear, anxiety, discomfort of another person's experience who is not like unto our own, that's where we fail in relationships.
What would it look like for an institution to do better?
Well, I think a very, very easy way, very easy way for our institution to have done 500% better than it did this past weekend in the women's conference is it could have focused on families, which is something I think we would all agree with is an important concept. It's an important institution, and there are very clear parameters of what makes a family successful, and they could have focused on that 100% without becoming abusive to any one gender or sexual orientation or specific, you know, singles versus grandparents, whoever is raising kids. There's some very clear ideas that most of the world would agree on that would be beneficial. And that could have been the complete focus. And to Gina's point, we had gay marriage, religious freedom, there was one more topic I forget though, all pretty much politically American issues going on right now in our country. Where's the rest of the church and what we're talking about?
Yeah, here, here.
I definitely hear that. I'm just trying to think, what is the demand upon them? I think our members, because of this equation of the church and God, and they're the mouthpiece and they're an authority figure and the church can satisfy me, so much of what is coming at them is, help us negotiate this difficult time. And so because as an institutional thing, we're not ready to expand the vision of marriage, you know, to include same-sex relationships, or to really, you know, spend too much time with the other forms of family, the single parents and things like this. We always want to put the ideal out there. This is what they're hearing, and they feel like they need to say those things. Because I would think we would have thought that a lot of these talks were actually kind of good, or they could have been good if they just wouldn't throw that extra line, you know, in there. And we know it's between one man and one woman only, or, you know, something like that. It was almost like 90% of it would have filled your criteria, Natasha, without just that extra little bit. But yet they know that that's in the air, and they need to answer it because people want answers.
But I think that they've answered it. And we're pretty clear in our church that until there's something coming out saying officially we have changed our position on this, that's the answer. We've heard the answer. We could have it in one talk or one statement. I don't think that it necessarily needs to be in every single talk, almost. I'd say
well,
like
90% but again,
of the talks.
So you're saying, saying have a strategy session and do assign talks, or at least convey to those who are chosen to speak, do not mention this. We'll cover it in one sentence at the appropriate time as we conduct. So you're actually calling for a change in how they assign topics.
Yeah. Yes, for sure.
I don't,
I mean, we're very good at coordination. I'm not sure why this doesn't have to be coordinated. At the same time, yeah, I would say we also have to start measuring the difference between, and I say this to couples all the time, is it more important to be right or to be married? So is it more important to make sure that every single person in the world knows that we are against gay marriage? Or is it more important to, you know, shepherd and sustain and to love and to, you know, try to find ways to help those who are painfully hurting in our church due to this statement that they continually make?
Yeah.
You know, what's more important?
Nice.
And I think that when it comes right down to it, I mean, it's something that they ask of us and I would ask of them is, what would Jesus Christ do? I don't think Jesus Christ was busy making policy statements. He was busy serving and making very, what I would like to say are unifying in the sense of values statements. Of, you know, in fact, he often went beyond the rule and said, you know what, in this case, the rule might not need apply because look at what's more important. The suffering is more important. I don't understand why that's so complicated. These are smart people. These are people I respect. These are people that I know spend tons of time. And I know I could hear it in our General Relief Society president's voice that she would say, I know this is painful that we talk about this, and yet she would still need to talk about it. So I know that they're aware that there are huge issues going on, but at some point I think we need to choose the suffering versus the correctness. I think that that's, in a sense, what every family system has to decide.
Nice.
Am I going to kick my kid out because they're not obeying the rules? Or is this where I need to have some empathy, compassion, and figure out, you know, be more creative in my ways of dealing with my household so that we can make sure that we include this kid who's probably hurting in ways we don't even understand. These are not difficult concepts. They apply to small groups. They apply to large groups.
I was thinking about conferences, you know, for the first time, I don't know how many years, I really paid very little attention to conference, and I felt that that was important just for my own sanity. But I was passing through the study when Nathan, my husband, was listening to Dieter Uchtdorf's talk on authenticity.
Mm-hmm.
And then I was sort of thought, you know, I'll stick my ear in for his next talk. And the thing that really struck me is the simplicity of those gospel-centered messages. And the frustration that we just don't concentrate on those. I don't know why we fetishize the family and kind of, you know, and you know, pay so much attention to a particular version of our social organization that, you know, somehow we find more valuable than the concept of grace.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's the power of other religions, you know, kind of more inclusive religions that they do talk about. It doesn't matter who you come to church with. It matters that you come and then you partake of the, you know, the Eucharist, you take the sacrament. And there will be very kind of poignant talks about very crucial aspects of Christian doctrine. I don't know what our doctrine is anymore. Do you know? I really don't know what we believe in, because I think fundamentally there are too many voices. There's too much talk. 10 hours of talk for a weekend. That's just insanity. I just wish people would just shut up and listen. Do you know? I don't, people come to our, you know, our stake. We're required to listen. You know, when was the last time visiting authorities came to our stake and said, tell us your story. We really need to hear our story. And I just, you know, it's just frustrating. Just, you know, for goodness sakes, just shut up. And I think, you know, most of our healing will come. People just be quiet. Yeah, anyway.
Well, did you notice, Dad, that she said that for her own sanity, she's just not even listening to conference?
Yeah, no,
that's part of that boundary, right? So placing boundaries, and we're not a culture that's strong on boundaries. You know, it's that for many people that would be seen as an incorrect choice, whereas I see that as a healthy boundary placement for her to be able to relate with her religion in a healthy way.
Yeah, and I in some ways I'm with her in the sense that it is healthier for me sometimes to not hear exactly everything that is said. But again, I think, like you were just talking about, somebody said, well, I have a podcast. You know, I know it's going to come up. I kind of feel like I need to know it and have my own judgment on it before I read everybody else's online and kind of that. So I do it partly for this job of mine. But again, because of differentiation, because of the healthy boundaries, because I'm decently secure with my own, you know, judgment, you know, on, you know, whether this should apply to me, whether this is, you know, a place to really go inside myself and take this principle to heart and really wrestle with it and come out with a good change, you know, because I feel all that stuff, you know, I don't necessarily feel damaged when I do listen to all of it. You know what I mean? So, and I guess in some ways that's maybe what I'm hoping this discussion will end up being is, you know, recognize in some ways all the different dynamics that are going on in a general conference and, you know, be healthy about it, because if we're thinking it's going to meet all of our needs and that this church is going to meet all of our needs, we're in for a long haul. So,
yeah, and I just want to say just one quick thing about that. I know that there's a lot of expectation around general conference, a lot of excitement that people want to go. You know, they want to be there to listen to whatever thing is going to be said, because that's going to change their lives. And I've realized recently that it's not going to change my life. It's just going to irritate me.
Yeah.
And I think it's really important that we don't have that expectation. Like,
yeah.
You know, as you say, it's like, it's not going to, it's whatever healthy work that we do to get ourselves emotionally, you know, healthy and strong. It's our daily interactions with God, or our, you know, whatever, whenever we have an interaction with God, it's our calling upon the deity. It's whatever we need to survive, you know, and to be kind of full spiritual creatures and emotionally healthy. That's the sacred work that we do. That's our sacred labor. Not to kind of show up to endless talks, kind of driveling on about the same stuff. That's not sacred labor. That's just, you know, an exercise and kind of futility and, you know, abuse. That was a bit harsh, wasn't it?
It wasn't too bad. It wasn't too bad.
Well, and again, for some people, I mean, I know people that I mean, General Conference is very uplifting, you know, and it's just, I guess that's my main message that I want to come back to, is that it's okay if it is uplifting to you, and it is okay if you find it abusive.
There you go.
And, you know, that both of those are okay. And that, how do we make room for that? Because right now, really, it's only okay if it's uplifting. And if it's not, back to Gina's point, you know, somebody might beat you up over it. So, which obviously I don't know if that's for real, but, you know, that's the level of emotional upheaval that happens. And that's the level of threat that people experience when somebody raises their hand quietly and says, I'm not sure that, you know, fits for me or applies for me, or I don't see it that way, or that's not my lived experience. Those are not really things we're comfortable saying. Testimony meetings sound the same for a reason. We're comfortable with a certain script. And if you digress from that, if you're a convert, it's cute because you're new.
That's right.
But if you're not a convert, then it's dangerous. And it's not, it's going to put you on the oust.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that actually kind of leads me a little bit. I wanted to steer us back to, you know, the initial framing of, you know, what led to the frustration that those would do any opposed, you know. And earlier I mentioned, Natasha, that you used the phrase, I want to share my opposing view or something like that. And I just caught that, wrote that in my notes to say, is there any help, again, you can use your counseling stuff to actually not even frame it in your head and in your mind as I have an opposing view, even though, you know, you have something to say. It isn't what the mainstream is used to hearing. It's not, we want to say it in a way that's not exactly the norm. But is there something when we add the label of I am opposed, I am going to stand here and be in opposition, that changes the energy in a way that will be hard to overcome? And are we being authentic to ourselves if we simply do frame it in terms of, you know, my life experience does not lead me to go in that same direction, and here's why. Let me tell you about it.
Right. Well, it's kind of an interesting question. I'm not sure I have a great answer to it. I think that we are very, very quick to know what things mean even before the language comes out of our mouth. For example, with couples, I often tell them, I mean, the reaction time that you have to one another is in nanoseconds. And, you know, a person can say, well, I didn't mean it that way, or I didn't say that, when your spouse knows exactly what you've said and how you meant it. And so whether or not you use different language, you know, at Sunday school, you know, people are going to pick up pretty quickly that you're not toeing the line. At the same time, from an individual perspective, I do think that there's value in reframing. I mean, this is what we see with so many of the groups that are out there right now, you know, nuanced Mormons, New Order Mormons. I mean, people are trying to find language that means, hey, I'm still in, I still care, I still want to be involved. I just am not comfortable being, completely complacent with things that I see as harmful to our community. And I do want to be an advocate, or I do want to see change. And that's the space, I think, that we're really delving with some discomfort right now, because the more traditional approach really doesn't make space for that. And that's, I just think, if you're in one of those nuanced spaces, that's just par for the course right now. It's just kind of the way it is. We're not, we don't have enough history in that space to really have it be a place of comfort yet. It is a place of agitation. It's seen as a place of agitation. And unfortunately of opposing, even though, you know, if you spent time talking with many of those of us in those spaces, we are very committed to the church, right? I mean, Dan, you know this, Gina, you know this, we love the church. We want to see it thrive. We want to see health. And yet, you know, there come certain moments where you just can't stand quiet when you see people in pain. And I think that for, you know, the homosexual issue is a huge one currently going on in our culture. I think gender roles is another huge issue in our culture. I think how money is spent is another huge issue in our culture. There's just, you know, 5 to 10 really prominent issues that that people feel strongly enough about that they want to follow what they've been taught, which is do what is right, let the consequence follow. And that sure works well when we're all on the same page of do what is right means.
Yeah.
But it's not, it's very uncomfortable when we all have different ways of feeling out what that means for me and my life and what I feel is important to be an advocate for. You know, I love this new group, the Mama Dragons, you know, the mothers of homosexual children who have banded together. What a superb, courageous group of women who are standing up for what they believe in, being courageous, doing what is right, let the consequence follow. And there have been awful consequences. Consequences that, quite frankly, I'm ashamed of that come from our community. It's really it's amazing how many things we can excuse in the name of God. And we think that that's something of the past, and yet we see it all around us. It's embarrassing for me sometimes how we act towards one another in the name of God.
Mm-hmm. Where do you guys find your, again, this is now going back into typical Mormon Matters mode, which is like, hey, people, I mean, even though this is a tri-release podcast, I guess I've been done most of the hosting here, but is your strength from God, Gina? Is your strength from your education? What keeps you in the fight? And, you know, you've admitted that it was good for you to take this weekend off from active listening. So, somewhere along the line, you're drawing strength to stay in and to keep engaged even in the tension. Do you feel like sharing how you do that?
Yeah, you know, it's a hard one because I ask myself that question every week, you know, before I go to church. What keeps me going? And I suppose, I feel called to Mormonism.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I know for a lot of people that's not adequate enough. What they want to hear is that I understand that I have a testimony that the church is true. Do you know what? I don't even understand what that means.
Right,
that
me either.
Notion of the church being true, I don't know what it means. I choose to believe things. I choose to believe that Joseph Smith was a prophet. I choose to believe in a restoration. And I call that restoration a reformation. And so I choose to believe in a church that needs to be reforming. And as a church that is reforming, and reforming Christianity and creating, making a good contribution to, well, should be making a contribution to Christianity. I believe I'm a reformer. Do you know, if I felt that God had called me to this religion to be an automaton, to put up with dehumanization of, you know, extreme, you know, religious sort of, you know, factions, then I think I'd be gone, you know, throw in my toys and go find another playground to play in. And in terms of my education, you know, I'm thinking about, you know, this action that these people have, you know, did the, any opposed people. You know, as a sociologist, I'm thinking, you know what, the remedy for something like groupthink, which we're just riddled with. And groupthink is, you know, the notion that we all must think and be conform, and we insulate ourselves from outside opinions, and we have this illusion of invulnerability. We think that we are inherently moral, and all of these things. I mean, this is a function of a social group, a subculture, and the remedy for groupthink will always emerge. And that remedy for groupthink is always dissent, and it's resistant, and it's resistance, and it's contestation. It always does. There is no getting away from it. You cannot have an institution that survives who embraces the notion of groupthink and not have resistance. Emerge. It's just not possible. I'm not going to say whether I agree or don't agree with, that's not the point with any opposed people. I think it's inevitable. And I think it's inevitable that our religion will be pushed and pushed and pushed
over and over and over again until it reclaims its original mission to be a reform, you know, to be truly be a witness of the radical intentions of Jesus Christ, which was to be a reformer of the spiritual and the divine, you know, our conversations about the spiritual and the divine, to be a reformer, a religious reformer. I think that's what Christ's major work was. Yeah.
Good stuff. Natasha, what is it? Do you feel called to it? Do you just, is it, what recharges your batteries? What keeps you in the fray?
Well, that seems to differ on any given day.
Very good.
I think, I mean, you know, we can't, you know, as a Mormon, as a mental health professional, obviously the goal is to be as bias free as possible. And that's like an impossible task, right? And so I fully concede that my spiritual journey has been framed and formed by many things, my own personal experience, the experiences of the people I have worked with, my education, my family origin. I mean, there's, you know, probably 50 different things I could list off that have formed my spiritual journey. Mm-hmm. My spiritual education came from Mormonism. You know, my parents converted and found, you know, a message there that was hopeful and edifying and enlightening to them. And that was always an interesting, you know, kind of paradigm growing up as a child of converts. You're always kind of wondering, huh, I wonder if I would have converted, you know, if Would I be in this religion if it wouldn't have been for my parents? And at least that seemed to cross my mind a lot growing up. And, you know, and at this point, my love for Mormon people, even though I'm kind of an adopted child, because I think converts just have a very different experience, I found, than those who've really, you know, been in for 3 to 4 generations or more, as many have been. But my love for this family is profound, and, you know, my love for Mormon doctrine and the depth in which it can explore is also profound, at least for me. That's been my experience. Now, I have run the gamut of doubts, and I can go back and forth on what I decide to call myself any given day. And maybe this is something I wanted to talk to you a little bit about as well, is I feel like religion in general serves us best when it's useful. And so I often have clients who will say, you know, it's so sad to me that I can no longer believe this because I've changed my testimony. And many times what they wish they could still believe in are things that are way beyond Mormonism, you know, like the afterlife or forever families or, you know, things that just kind of tend to give hope and, you know, help us deal with the insecurities and unknowns about life and what it's all about, which is a lot of what I think religion does is try to help people figure out questions or answers to those questions. And so I have learned to really be careful to not throw out the baby with the bathwater per se, and you know, call me cafeteria all you want to all day long, but I am a great believer of cafeterias being great places for me to pick and choose what is edifying and nutritious and catches my eye and is good for my heart and soul. And, you know, I think that's a big part of how I deal with Mormonism. I find great richness in it. At the same time, because of that, I find myself needing to advocate for places where there is much pain. And I think I have gotten to a place where that has become more of a calling for me. I don't know that I would have said that a few years ago. It felt maybe a little pretentious, but, and I don't mean to be, you know, prideful in that at all. I just mean that there's a certain level of responsibility that I feel when people put pain on my table, and I can't just stand by and watch that go unnoticed or unheeded or on top of it provoked. So,
and by that you mean I now need to speak to it at the institutional level, or I help heal them by holding their pain, acknowledging their pain. You know, that there's a great, you know, difference between healing somebody and curing them. You know, like if you were to make their pain sacred through acknowledging it, or are you saying you now need to take that extra step and actually try to change the institution?
Well, so both. I mean, I don't have any, you know, ideas that I'm going to change the institution, but I do see myself as a voice. You know, I mean, I blog, I have Mormon Mental Health Podcast. I'm forming this association of professionals so that we can really start addressing this idea of having competent mental health professionals working with LDS clientele, whether they're Mormon themselves or not. There's issues on both sides of that, you know, for non-LDS professionals who really are clueless as to the myriad of issues that Mormons bring to the table. And then, of course, there's those of us who are Mormon who bring our own biases to the table, right? So either way, there's cultural competence that needs to be addressed. And I think for a long time, because I wanted to be that blank slate, I only did it in my office, like you're talking about, holding that pain, validating pain. Not that that's necessarily a cure, but it's definitely part of a healing process.
Yeah.
But I think, yeah, it goes beyond that now when I see harmful messages, you know, either given locally or internationally. It doesn't give me great pleasure to feel like, my job is secure for the next 10 years because General Conference was so awful this time, you know. So that doesn't bring me great pleasure. There's lots of things I could be successful in treating without having added Mormon issues, you know. So, yeah, so it's a little bit of both, Dan.
Yeah, yeah. No, I hear you, and I feel like I speak up too, you know, but yet my is it my personality or whatever it is I'm not a big gesture person. I'm generally not like a, you know, like when I was just feeding or, you know, tempting you with the, you know, reframing it in our heads. I never in my brain think I am offering an opposing view. I try to say I'm offering a new perspective or an additional perspective, or let me point our, turn our necks, you know, 5 degrees to this direction or something, or let's look a little bit deeper or something like that. So it does help me to not, when I don't think of myself as opposing things, I think it helps me not make the big gesture kind of thing, which I sort of see any opposed doing, which I see, you know, John and I see ordained women and these things. Not that we don't need those gestures, because that's what gets great conversations going. But for me, it's not how I go too. But I'm with you. I try to hear. I try to be large enough to acknowledge the pain, to hear the story, to validate it. And I do want to offer the change. I guess maybe I'm just in the natural role that I'm doing here with this podcast, which is more on the, let's frame it as big as possible. Let's look at all the different factors that are at play here. And so if I were to answer the question that I posed to you guys, I do, like you, Gina and Natasha, I have had that strong sense of being called to this, like having my whole autobiography, you know, kind of pointing towards the kind of work I'm doing. But I do see my way of activism and stuff is in more of this education, throwing out the widest possible thinking, trying to always, you know, have empathy. And I guess when I come to conference, you know, I sit there and listen to these guys, and on especially the rough talks, I'm like, okay, if I were going to speak on this topic, what would I write? You know, what would my topic be, or how would I say it? And how much could I get away with, you know, in the church? Like, for instance, I loved President Uchtdorf's priesthood meeting talk, as well as his one on Sunday morning on grace. You know, my natural tendency would have been to go further, but yet I think he, more skillfully than me, you know, was able to read the situation, know, you know, where his rhetoric would, you know, do the most good, and he's able to walk that line. So I sometimes worry that we're like we forget to be empathetic. What would it be like when people are hanging on our every word, when our ideas somehow count in their heads, sometimes more than their own ideas? You know, what would I say? And I don't know, there's a certain level of empathy that I have for the brethren on being in a situation where they cannot ever forget that they have a huge microphone and it's going to be recorded forever. And, you know, they can't always say what they want to say. So at least that helps me, along with all the other, you know, pieces that we've talked about here, is just to remember these guys are trapped in many ways by their own job. But that doesn't mean I don't want them to quit doing these either or statements, or these, you know, all or nothing, or the statements like we were talking about earlier that simply marginalize and, you know, emphasize being right over being loving.
Nice, Dan. Nice.
So I don't want to make this longer than it needs be, which I know we're already past that point probably, but I don't necessarily want to be the sole voice in this. So let me ask the two of you a question.
Please.
Because I know that, maybe I'm assuming, Gina, you can correct me, but knowing Dan as well as I know him, I know a big part of like your calling or your spirituality involves this framing of Mormonism into more palatable pieces that more people could sit at the table on, right? So this idea that the bigger tent or the bigger table where more of us could sit together. And I feel like I was the only one necessarily today talking about, you know, sitting with those at the table that really don't want to participate with Mormonism or God or those types of maybe religious types of framings. What would you say as far as your own spirituality being able to either embrace or reject or whatever it is that comes to mind for the two of you in dealing with the many people who surround us who are in those positions?
Good question. I don't know what to say, Natasha. Well, in terms of communing with I don't have any problem with engaging these very, very hard questions about who is God and I'm happy to be. I'm not certain, you know, Natasha. I think that's the thing. I'm not certain. I've had tremendous spiritual experience, but it doesn't give me any certainty. You know, I don't know if there's a God. I choose to believe there's one. I choose to believe that those experiences that I had were with God, but what if he's not there? You know, I don't know. I mean, hanging over me are always, you know, I have to kind of counterbalance, you know, I tend to counterbalance everything with a hard question for myself. I think my table's big enough for anybody, really. I hope it is. I mean, I hope the fact that I feel quite kind of convicted by, you know, certain spiritual experiences would have put people off talking to me about their own experiences, which aren't, maybe very much different from my own. I don't know. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, I really like that. I like the ability that you had just then to say, you know, I choose to believe and this is how I frame things, but there's a possibility that it could be very different, which I think just in saying that validates somebody who might be sitting across from you and having a different experience. Whereas oftentimes, I think in Mormonism, we've been taught to testify versus just validate, right?
Yeah.
And I really am curious to hear from you, Dan, because I feel like you're often put in the position, and it's a difficult position, I think, that you're in to walk this line of trying to convince people that there might be something worth wrestling with, right? And I've heard you say that many times, and I agree that there are things worth wrestling with. But I'm just wondering if you had the space to not worry about that for just a minute and speak to this other possibility, what would you say?
Yeah, well, I mean, the first thing that happened when you said, you know, what about engaging with that, was I do that. I'm in a weekly lunch group, and you've been a guest at that, Natasha. And I'm also in a monthly guys group where we've had a couple of iterations of our names that began, you know, 10 or more years ago, and especially with the monthly group, I'm talking about everybody returned missionary, everyone married in the temple, and now only four of us are even engaging Mormonism, you know, at any kind of activity level at all. And I'd say 3 to 4 of the guys have moved into full-blown atheism. And so our discussions and our everything like that are super interesting and things like that. And you kind of, to me, hit the answer, or at least you kind of said the language that what it falls to me to do is not so much as testify as much as simply share and say, well, here's my experience, here's the framing I put on it. I recognize that that is not, you know, it isn't the process of deduction. In other words, I haven't asserted XYZ in such a way that if you, you know, set those things up, it's going to lead inevitably to the conclusion I have. I always want to say, you know, this is my experimentation. This is what's happening in my life, and here is my tentative conclusions. I love William James at the end of The Varieties of Religious Experience. He goes, let me tell you about my overbeliefs. You know, I recognize these are the things that I'm suggesting, you know, on pretty shaky ground or tentative evidence, but yet here I have to share those. And so that's what I try to do when I'm, you know, I certainly listen and validate. And some of these friends who, you know, are actively atheist or challenging me every step of the way, I've just come to love it and to enjoy it and to feel challenged by it and to wrestle. And, you know, sometimes it's like, next time I'm going to come with a better, you know, way of phrasing it, and it's going to make all the difference in the world to them. But, you know, of course that never happens, right? But I'm grateful to be in the presence of those who don't believe like me. You know, I've kind of gotten to the point where I teased a little earlier, can we have tension and disagreement enliven our lives, you know, rather than make us feel like I've got to escape this tension at all cost. And so I love it. I don't know if that helps at all.
Yeah, no, I love that too. And it reminds me of this principle that we often speak about, which is humility. And I don't know that we're very good at that when it comes to our positions on beliefs, you know, in Mormonism. Like, can we really sit across somebody who has different beliefs from us and really genuinely think, I have somebody in front of me whom I can learn from, not necessarily whom I can teach. And, you know, I think we've been so missionary focused in our culture that we're wanting to teach and share, which is great. I mean, there's nothing wrong with wanting to share something that you find useful and helpful in your life. But oftentimes, you know, the unfortunate result of that is that we can be seen as condescending or higher than, or, you know, that somehow, yeah.
And these guys will call me on this sometimes too. So, yeah. So but that's right. A very active critique in my ears. Yes.
Well, yeah, I think that's true of all of it. I don't know how any of us escape that, you know, completely. But it's something that I think, you know, just being mindful of is useful too. It's always interesting to me what people laugh at General Conference, what they find funny. And oftentimes I think they're quite condescending things, unfortunately. So it's kind of like, oh yeah, ha ha ha, that, you know, they didn't quite understand, or they didn't get it, or, you know, them versus us. When, you know, I love what Joseph Smith said, that, you know, bring what you have to my table and we'll go back and forth and see, you know, what we have to share and what we have that will actually benefit from each other and learn from each other. I don't know how well he was at that in practice, but it's a beautiful thought as far as, you know, kind of that idea that I have something to learn from you, instead of this position that we come at, that we have all the answers and our way is the right way. And if you don't, and I think that's oftentimes what breaks down the communication barrier, unfortunately. So that's a big question to ask of ourselves as Mormons, is how do we have the beliefs that we do about how valuable it is what we hold, and at the same time be able to hold other people's, you know, stories, experiences, and frameworks just as valuable. I think that's, I don't know that we're very good at that.
We're not taught to do that, Natasha. That's not
right,
part of
our
curriculum.
Quite frankly, yeah, we suck at it, so.
It's, yeah, terrible.
But it is also, you know, back to Gina earlier on, it's kind of a gift of the Spirit. It's a fruit of the Spirit. To be so grounded, to be centered yourself in you and God, it's much easier to do that than when you're on that ground of us versus them, or, you know, rightness matters more than relationship and stuff like that. So I'm back with Gina, always encouraging people to, you know, meet God for yourself, or at least meet your highest self, you know, through whatever means possible. But there is a spiritual energy that I'm acquainted with, and that is a valuable part of my life. And I certainly has, you know, I've had peak moments, and I've kind of settled for most of my time these days into just sort of you know, a song in the background, sort of at the base of my life. This remembrance of something larger than the day to day and what's happening in front of me. But somewhere in between, in the middle of all that, that's my spiritual journey, and it helps me do exactly what I think we're trying to say here. And so I'm all for seek that if you can, people. My experience is that it's real, but I don't know how to talk to the person, or other than, you know, if you haven't had that experience, I don't know what to say to you other than I hope you'll not give up.
Well, yeah. Or maybe that experience is just in different language and we just
recognize
have to listen
it.
For that. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, it was interesting. Carlisle Hunsaker last night was talking about that whole, you know, it's the most interesting thing. The more you pursue it, the more elusive it becomes. You know, the paradox of Jesus, you know, to find your life, you have to lose your life. And so it's like, you know, hey, go for those spiritual experiences, everybody. And yet you're probably not going to get it when your whole concentration is to have one. But, you know, like for me, the one of the most profound ones, it was probably my third spiritual experience, you know, that just like was so, you know, bottom of the universe, fallout, connected with everything. Was it was an interesting one for me, where I wasn't at all focused on myself. It was on my mission in Mount Vernon, Washington, and just one of those mornings in my prayer where I just, you know, talked with the universe about every single person we were working with, you know, and somewhere along the line, just pouring out my heart for wanting the best for all these people. And by the time I enumerated 8 or 9 or 10 or 11 of them or whatever, I was just washed away into just this amazing bliss of love and connection. And, you know, the only reason I'm sharing that now is, you know, if we're too focused on just ourselves and all of our stresses, or if we're just too focused on getting a spiritual experience and that'll fix everything or something like that, I think the secret in some ways is, you know, do disciplines, do prayer, do whatever it is, and just watch what might come and happen. William James has the four elements of a spiritual experience. The first one is that it's ineffable. In other words, when you're in a spiritual experience, you're not going to be able to fully share it. Number two, that it does have some kind of noetic quality to it. There is some information that's being conveyed to you. The third one, though, is that it's transient. You know, it comes and it goes. It's only here for a certain period of time. And the fourth one is when you're in it, you're the passive recipient. It is happening to you. And so, you know, if we're go, 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 and it's got to come, and today's the day it's going to come, you know, it's probably not. We have to kind of turn our attention to good things. And I think lots of fun things can happen.
And when you think about those spiritual experiences, I mean, how many have you had, Dan?
I think 6 or 7. I had to rewrite them up. But, you know, and some of them were, you know, you can have the grade A, the B pluses, you know, the C's, you know, kind of thing. But yeah, you know, as far as A pluses, 4 for sure, and then, you know, a couple others that just have, you know, the world is different after. You know what I mean?
That's right.
I'm different. Yeah.
We're talking about one every 10 years, perhaps. You know, if we're lucky.
Or they just come when they come, but yeah, they're rare for sure.
Yeah, that you know, extraordinary. extraordinary.
But they do leave their trace. You know, for me, it was an energy trace that, you know, it does dissipate over time and things like this. But I think now from, you know, years of being in this comfort zone with God and my own spirit and things like this, not that God isn't always, you know, knocking me aside the head and say, pay attention and do this or change this or something. But I have been able to grab that sort of baseline, you know, sense of spiritual presence throughout my life, you know, most of the day, you know, now. And so, like you say, you know, once every 10 years, I'm trying to say there's still a residual effect that I think that we can have in our lives. At least my experience is that I have it in my life from years of disciplined, you know, practice of it.
And just really briefly, I think, you know, I think that we've got to continue to ask really hard questions. And, you know, for me, I mean, I'm thinking about life after death and, you know, what if there was no resurrection? And this is a question that I've been asking myself recently. You know, what if there was no resurrection? I can't go as far as saying that, you know, what if there was no God? Because I think whatever God is, I feel that I've experienced some measure of presence with that. But what if the question of the resurrection wasn't, you know, there was no resurrection, that life after death, that my life was extinguished and all of my knowing and all of my being was extinguished at my passing. And it made me feel like terribly uncomfortable, but, you know, something kind of ineffable happened also in that space, where I felt enormous comfort with the life that I have now.
Do you know,
it was kind of its own spiritual experience. It was own profound experience. In contemplating the possibility that this would be the end, this is my shot. Yes. That my life took on different hues just for that moment. And I think I loved my family a little harder than I, you know, did before. So, I mean, you know, coming from it. Yeah.
Those are important moments. Those are the kinds of questions that I think we should all be asking. And I've had similar experiences. Yeah. Natasha, you want to offer anything kind of as we head out?
No, I really enjoyed listening to both of you talk about these different framings. I just, I think back on my life, I think most of us could think back on our lives and find times that really stood out, you know, for whatever reason, whether we see it as a spiritual moment or an emotional moment or, you know, a loving moment. Again, these are things that I just think, unfortunately, our language holds a lot of these things hostage you know, when you talk about, you know, having a spiritual moment that's, you know, comes from religious practice, you know, I can imagine that means, you know, that you maybe are pretty good at prayer or reading scripture, or, you know, that there's certain things in your life that you have found very useful and that you've done, you know, pretty consistently, and that that's been of great reward to you. And I want to completely validate that. And I think that there are others that, you know, would have a very different experience and yet have very rewarding experiences as well to report. And I guess my invitation to myself and to everyone is to listen for that, you know, to listen for the complexity of you know, how language can sometimes get in the way of really what's being tried to be communicated and share in the beauty of each other's experiences, even if they come about in very different ways or have very different meaning to us.
Yeah, nice.
Love it. Gina, anything else as we go?
Nope.
Thanks, you guys. It's wonderful. We did promise everybody who's listening a free flow. I think we ended up with a free flow here. We started out a little more focused, but kind of gotten to just things that I think are wonderful and close to our hearts. And I hope it's been a neat couple hours for everybody who's tuned in and listened this far, that this is that you felt like in your head you're you're nodding or you're shaking your heads or your fists, or I can't wait to go to these guys' blogs and write a question or a comment to tell them this or that or the other thing. But whatever it is, I hope it's been a fruitful couple hours for you, because I've really loved it, and I love these great people that I am doing podcasts alongside, and I'm grateful for your voices and the way you guys contribute, for sure. So thank you guys.
Thank you Dan and Gina. Yeah. Thanks, Natasha.
So we'll co-release this here pretty quick. So by the time you're all listening to it, it should still be conference week. And thanks, everybody, for tuning in. And please support your favorite podcast. Right?
That's right.
Everybody here loves donations and subscriptions. So don't forget
very
us.
Very helpful.
Yes, thanks very much. We love it, and it's a calling. But we'll take paid ministry at times, right?
I'm just trying to pay the production.
That's right, yeah. Well, great. Thanks, guys.
All right, thank you, Dan.
Thanks, Dan.
Good night.
Good night.
Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Matters Podcast. To discuss this podcast with others, please check us out at mormonmatters.org. To keep this podcast alive, or to join our support community, please consider a tax-deductible donation today at mormonmatters.org. Music for this podcast was brought to you by Brittany and Clayton Pixton. The Mormon Matters logo was generously provided by StudioCase.com. Thank you for listening.